Welcome to Best Picture This, where it is always Oscar season. I'm Mike.
And I'm Brian. In this show, we reevaluate every Best Picture nominee from the 21st century and decide whether to keep it or kick it from its Oscar pedestal.
Do you ever wonder, Brian, when we kick these movies, where do they go?
Do they feel it?
Do they go to Neverland? Does that make you feel good if they do? Does it warm your soul?
To determine the fate of a movie?
Yeah.
Forever?
Yeah. Follow-up question. Can you do an Irish accent for the rest of this podcast?
No. Johnny Depp's pretty good at it,
though. He is. I like his accent in this. Mm-hmm. But in 2004, the nominees for Best Picture were Ray, Sideways, Million Dollar Baby, The Aviator, and today's movie, Finding Neverland, directed by Mark Forster. Here's the trailer.
Who do you belong to?
Excuse me, sir. You're standing on my sleeve.
I might point out you're lying under my bench.
Do you mind just playing with your dog?
No, go on.
So sorry, my boy's bothering you.
Jay and Barry, pleased to meet you.
Jay and Barry, the author.
He was looking for the inspiration he had lost.
Your play this evening.
I think I can do better.
They were longing for the family they once had.
He died, the husband.
He left her with four boys.
What began as a chance encounter...
Perhaps we'll see you here tomorrow, then.
...will forever change their lives.
James, may I take your hat?
You are not my father.
Peter's a different boy since his father died.
It's just a dog.
Peter.
Just a dog? With a wee bit of imagination, I can see the great bear, Porthos.
Striving to be some kind of public eccentric.
Bang, bang, bang!
You should be aware, James, what some people have been saying.
Have you no idea how much your friendship has already cost my daughter?
The boys need a father.
What are you suggesting?
Films presents...
It's the best you've written, James.
The story of a man...
What's it like, Neverland?
One day I'll take you there.
...who awakened the world's imagination.
Young boys should never be sent to bed. They always wake up a day older.
And the people...
I need to go on pretending with you.
...who inspired him.
You have a man who is a fairy, right? And this girl calls herself Tinker.
That is Neverland.
Johnny Depp, Kate Winslet, Julie Christie, and Dustin Hoffman.
You can visit Neverland anytime you like.
How?
By believing, Peter. Just believe.
Finding Neverland.
You think this would be considered a cameo for Dustin Hoffman?
He does seem like he's going to be a character in the movie for the first 15 minutes and then he kind of disappears. I do love, though, the tie-in, his Peter Pan tie-in. He plays Captain Hook in Hook, and now here he is saying how Peter Pan can never work.
Apparently, there was like lines in the play where he's supposed to like talk more about Hook, and he didn't want to do that because it would seem like it was... playing on the other movie.
Felt a little too on the nose.
A little distraction, yeah.
And how about the narration in that trailer? Do you think that it's any coincidence that a movie like this, which I'm not saying is not for me, but a movie like this that's more in the Cider House Rules world.
It's more in the Shock-a-Lot world.
Yes, and it has that kind of trailer.
Mm-hmm. I think it's more of the time. I mean, I think all trailers basically had this. It'll be interesting again when we get to the point where this kind of narration fades away from trailer trends. So this movie won an Oscar. Jan A.P. Kaczmarek won for Best Original Score. It was nominated for Best Actor, Johnny Depp.
I'm just thinking about the score, Oscar. I'm a little hung up on that.
Practically every score that has been nominated and that we say, I'm always kind of like, oh yeah, well, I don't really remember anything all that extraordinary about the score.
Which I would argue sometimes is a good thing. Because you want the score to kind of work on your emotions without feeling it and being aware of it. But in a movie like this, it's very traditional, stringy stuff.
Johnny Depp's best performance. This is one of his Oscar nominations.
No, it's a good one. He's good in it.
He's good.
But it's not his best.
It was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay by David McGee. He adapted it from a 1998 play called The Man Who Was Peter Pan by Alan Nee. Mark Forster directed, and this was his next movie after Monsters Ball, which was the best movie of 2001. he went on to do Stranger Than Fiction, Quantum of Solace, James Bond movie, World War Z, and then Christopher Robin, which feels a lot more like Finding Neverland. But interesting, you know, he said in an interview that he purposely tries to like go 180 on different movies. Hmm. It was made for $25 million and it made $116.8 million in the box office. Smashing success.
Yeah, huge.
Coming up in the show, we'll do our Farley Awards for the most awesome moment of the movie, Golden Takes. We'll ask each other one question that while we are wearing the Nana the Dog costume of truth, we will imagine what might have been, talk trivia, and the big reveal, will you keep it or kick it from the top five?
But first, our best moment of the movie, our Farleys. And for me, it's when Peter Pan is performed in a living room. Mm-hmm. The scene is good stuff. So
a good moment.
Kate Winslet's character is sick and she can't leave the house, so she can't go see this play. So Johnny Depp's character brings the play, which he wrote, to her living room, and she watches it with her mom and her four boys. That's the setup. But I love this sequence because it's not on a stage. There are really no props. And I think it doesn't matter for one thing. And I think that the fact that it doesn't matter reinforces how little we need to let our imagination take over, connect those dots, and just run wild and start to connect with these characters who are wearing these kind of shabby costumes. And that's all we need.
It was nominated for best costumes.
Really?
You're calling them shabby?
Well, I think that's more like the three-piece suits that Johnny Depp is wearing and the corsets that Kate Winslet's in.
That is kind of interesting, though, isn't it? That this was nominated for costume design. I mean,
it was a period piece, man. They always do this. It's like a prestige period piece. So let's give it the score Oscar and let's give it a costume nomination. But
this is your nightmare to be in a period piece.
Maybe it is. But I love this scene because of that kind of magical imagination element, mm-hmm. that right when the play starts, you kind of think like, oh boy, the guy in the dog costume is just going to crawl in their living room. How's this going to work? And then a couple seconds later, you forget about that. The artifice is gone and you buy in. Mm-hmm. So I brought a clip of this scene that I wanted to play. And in it, Peter Pan just realizes that Tinkerbell drank poison to save his life.
Tink, are you dying? Her light is growing faint. If it goes out, that means she's dead. Her voice is so low I can scarcely hear what she's saying. She says she thinks she could get well again if children believed in fairies. Do you believe in fairies? Say quick that you believe. If you believe, clap your hands. Clap louder.
So before the music swells,
I was going to say,
I'm into it.
Is that your favorite part of that clip, the music?
I do like the music in the background. It's very atmospheric when she's asking, do you believe in fairies? When it swells, that's the kind of thing that you expect from that moment. But Kelly MacDonald, I just want to point her out. She's
Peter Pan.
Yeah, she's the one playing Peter Pan. And I think that she's really good because she's kind of asked in this moment to play maybe the biggest emotional moment of the film. And it's a character that we have not followed at all. So it's like she just has to enter and kind of steal the scene. And I think that she does.
Yeah.
She's really good.
She is very good. The last movie we saw her in was Gosford Park, and she's really good in that as well.
Yeah, and in Boardwalk Empire, she's like the star of that, at least for the first few seasons. But when the music does kick in, the last thing I'll say about this sequence is the backdrop sort of behind these performers lifts up, and it shows their backyard, which has a bunch of other performers that we weren't expecting there and a lot of set dressing. And Kate Winslet, we kind of enter her perspective at this point, and she walks out into the backyard. And it's cool because we don't really know where the play ends and her imagination begins, because like Peter flies for a moment. How did that happen? There are other things that look like they're kind of more than costume and makeup. And those lines are great. And I got to say, Brian, during this whole thing, the room got a little dusty at the Cavalieri household.
You're crying in this?
I wasn't crying.
Is this the first time ever?
No, I wasn't actually crying, but I felt it coming. And of course, I pushed it down.
Of course.
Because I can't be.
You can't do that.
No, that's
you wouldn't be able to get to your horror marathon if you caught crying and finding Neverland.
It's true.
Well, that blurring of the line there, I thought also is one of the great accomplishments of the movie, that it becomes Neverland.
Yeah.
And you're wondering where the line is, and it refuses to answer those questions, mm-hmm. which I think is good. I wondered about the very ending, spoiler alert. They disappear at the end. Johnny Depp's character is sitting on the bench with Freddie Highmore, who's the real life Peter supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they talk and then they disappear. And I wondered, that was also kind of like kind of embracing the mystery of death and memory and imagination. I guess I was a little bit wondering what we were supposed to make of that. What did you think?
Right before that happens, mm-hmm. He's telling the little boy, your mom is gone, deal with it. But she's always with you, in your mouth. All you have to do is remember her basically. Mm-hmm. And she lives on in your memory. And that's the first time that the boy extends his imagination far enough to say, I can see her, and pretend that he does. And I think that maybe it's like them escaping to Neverland together for a moment. And then their story sort of continues from there. That's what I got.
Yeah,
from
that
it
could
anyway.
Be escaping there for a moment. Cause I mean, he leaves his bag there on the bench.
It's not like he umbrella. Dies. Yeah. I mean, come on. What if it rains?
You don't go anywhere back in those days without your umbrella.
No. And your walking stick. Seems like you have mm-hmm. two sticks to walk with.
I mean, people must have been afraid of falling down a lot back then. So my Farley Award was kind of related to yours, but this was actually during the performance of the play toward the end.
The orphans.
Yeah, the orphans coming in. You knew that it was going to, you knew it was going to be kids, because that's kind of why he would reserve the 25 seats,
mm-hmm.
Because you want to create the magic that the children themselves would bring in the audience.
Yeah, which is a really smart marketing move. Let's just say that.
It is indeed. And you got all these, stuffy people in their fancy dresses and suits sitting next to little kids. They're going to feel it as well.
Yeah.
And that's when, again, got dusty in the Cavalieri household.
It did. It did.
But the thing that was really great about that moment to me was when the flying happened on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
We had already been introduced to it. And in fact, we all know Peter Pan, so we know that people are going to fly. It's one of the early scenes that J.M. Barrie, played by Johnny Depp, sees when the kids are jumping on the bed when he first meets them in their house. He imagines them flying out the window. So you kind of got that idea of how he was inspired by it. But when the kids actually do fly on the stage with the ropes, and it's again clear artifice. You talk about complaining about seeing the wires or knowing that they're on wires in movies mm-hmm. now. This was obviously they're on ropes, but to see the kids' faces light up, wow,
they all gasp.
It was like the innovation, and then Dustin Hoffman's character is saying like, "Wow, this is genius. He did it." That was a really fun moment to me too.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right, golden take. What's your golden take, Mike?
My golden take is that this is the right approach to biopics.
Hmm.
So it's the kind mm-hmm. of approach that I was trying to articulate during the Ray episode.
The opposite of Ray. I thought about this being the opposite of Ray in many ways.
Yes, it is. A way of making a movie about a person, this case, J.M. Barrie, that's more about the way that person's work makes us feel than a biography about that person's life, rather than about that person specifically. It's kind of like following the inspiration of the person's work. And I was thinking about past biopics, American Splendor. So you have Harvey Pekar, his work in comic books kind of breaks the boundaries between real life and fiction. And the movie does the same thing, in this kind of subversive way. It starts to become about storytelling rather than about Harvey Pekar. And then here, Peter Pan, inspired generations of people, been around forever. Story connects us to our youth. And then Finding Neverland tries to dramatize that pull toward imagination rather than being about Barrie himself. That's great. Contrast that to something like Ray, that's basically just trying to tell the story of a life beat by beat, birth to death. And there's no comparing how one, to me, works as art and the other kind of works as product. So this is a biopic, but it doesn't feel like one. And I think that that means it's working.
Poor, poor Ray.
Poor Ray.
It's the Seabiscuit of 2004.
The easy kick. Do you think every year is going to have
the easy kick?
The one easy kick?
Probably. We'll see. We could probably run down the next few years and see.
Yeah.
We probably already know what it's going to be.
Maybe. Your golden take.
My golden take is that, again, I thought a lot about Ray. Ray is a movie about, I think that Finding Neverland is superior because it's about, you believe J.M. Barrie's drive to write more than you really believed Ray Charles's drive to create music in the movie. Mm-hmm. That was one, there's sort of this, it's like, how realistically does the movie depict the passion that the protagonist has?
Yeah. What does music do for Ray Charles?
This one, you believe J.M. Barrie's need to write and his passion for writing very well. I think that it succeeds in there. So it got me thinking about kind of overall trends of some things that we've seen. Movies about art or a similar passion, it could be, you may not consider this really an art, but their passion that drives their character, I think you can divide them into two categories. There's movies where the passion is a force for their character and movies that their passion is a benevolent force. Mm. So I have a list of some of the movies we've done episodes on. So in Finding Neverland, his passion, is it destructive or benevolent?
I was going to get a little bit into this with questions because I think that the movie is a little bit shrewd to kind of glaze over certain complications because it is a creative, positive force in his life, mm-hmm. except to how it pertains to his wife.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going in the questions with there too. Maybe let's just go there now and I'll come back to this. So continue on with your train of thought with the question then.
So you have this wife character, right?
And I like her. The actress does well. I forget what her name is. Rada? I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
I'll look it up here.
Yeah, I don't know. So let me just... I had a couple positive reviews of this movie, and I had a couple of...
Rada Mitchell.
Negative reviews. Do you want to hear the two good or the two bad first?
Let's hear the two bad.
Okay, the two bad reviews. We have Rex Reed, The Observer. He says, "It's harmless cotton candy with pleasant turn-of-the-century decor. But I admit the Disney ambiance eventually wore me out and I spent a lot of time looking at my watch." Stephen Ree, the Philadelphia Inquirer, says, "Twee is one of those distinctly English words. It's used to describe something flowery, fey, hopelessly lightweight. It can also be applied quite nicely, thank you, to Finding Neverland." The two good are Tom Long, Detroit News. He says, "A reminder that a sense of play is at the heart of every play, at the heart of every artistic endeavor for that matter, and yet life is more than just a playground." And Andrew Saris, The Observer, says, "Finding Neverland establishes its limits and then transcends them to provide a glorious entertainment for this holiday season." And I wanted to ask you, which side of that are you on?
I'm on the latter. I do think that this is, it is predictable. The movie's predictable.
Yeah.
You do have the kind of, I don't know, it's the period piece Oscar movie that we keep seeing pop up here.
Yeah. Doesn't take a lot of chances. It's very sentimental.
But it's the thing that the question it raises for me is, it seems like the type of movie that's not necessarily trying to make all the art critics happy. It's trying to make the audiences happy. And
potentially
it does a good job
in a manipulative way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with that necessarily.
Cute kids, dead parents. That's the equation.
Yeah, it's there a lot.
If you want to make an audience feel something, you get some cute kids and kill off their parents. And then, you know, you got gold there, Brian, gold.
I don't think that's all, though. I mean, the way the lighting,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that go into the kind of, we're trying to wring out every emotion here.
And by getting good actors to front it.
Yeah.
Because you have Kate Winslet in that moment that I was talking about in her living room. You can't see her, obviously, in the clip. She doesn't say anything. Mm-hmm. But just her face, you totally buy that she is at the same time captivated by this play and understanding that this Neverland thing is waiting for her because she is
So hang
sick.
On here. You said you totally buy it.
So you totally buy Winslet's performance.
So is it manipulative? If it worked, it worked. That's not manipulative.
You have an ending scene where a little boy, the cutest little boy face in the world, is looking up at Johnny Depp and basically saying, what do I do now? My dad is dead. My mom is dead. And you have this benefactor who's saying, don't worry, not only will I take care of you, but I'll help you dream. It's like, it's saccharine stuff. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
I think the movie is kind of saccharine. That's why I didn't like love the movie.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm not trying to disagree
there. But it works though. So like,
but if it works, then what are we complaining
about?
It
works. I gave it a 3.5 stars. Right?
I didn't catch up to your letterbox.
It's not one that I would criticize flat out. It's one of these where I'm aware of the moves that it's making to manipulate me, but it is manipulating me in a way that works. So it's almost like tip of the hat.
The surprises, like we just described, I think lift it up from what it could have been.
Yeah.
And I think that the other thing that was surprising and successful is that for the most part, I don't think it is like weepy and saccharine. I think a lot of it is very understated. I mean, I was realizing at the end of the movie, I think that there is only one time when a character raises his or her voice.
The little boy.
The little boy when he's trashing the play.
He won't be made a fool.
He won't be made of that. And also way too adult sounding lines for that kid. But Johnny Depp is quiet the entire time. So is his wife, who is seething underneath a lot of the time.
Yep.
Kate Winslet is very quiet.
Even the angry
Julie
mother.
Julie Christie is mostly quiet. It's interesting how they managed to do that and still, I think, make it pretty successful.
But at the same time, all of those characters, every single one, has nothing but the best of intentions. So it's like there's really nobody to dislike. There's nobody to mistrust. But it's not really in a way that is complicated, though, because I don't want to dislike certain characters. I think the fact that I like these characters should make their choices more complex. You know, it should be like, I see where his wife is coming from with this, and she's got a point, but also he has a point.
But
isn't there a line there between it being complicated because marriage and adulthood is complicated and being oversimplified by the director for us to kind of say, well, don't look at that. Don't think about that. Look over here instead.
I think that this is a distinction that we could talk about a lot more in future movies. I'll try to think of this with another future Golden Take sometime. To try to analyze it. But I think that there are, it's like a separation of different movies. Categorize them as, this is one where, generally speaking, all the characters do have understandable motives. And therefore, there isn't like a pure evil villain kind of a situation. And then there's others that they do have, like the evil villain situation. Here, there's a lot of conflict. You can have conflict in either one, but one is more situational and one is more like good versus evil. This is where I think a lot of horror is in the second category, where you have this supernatural evil kind of force, and it's less about just being stuck in the situation. Although Open Water is a little bit like that. Anyway, we're getting off track.
But bringing it back to the wife and this whole idea, early on, Hoffman complains about Barry's first play, and he says something like, the critics made it important, and that changed this whole thing. And I complain about this sort of fake importance in movies all the time, and I think that this one does avoid it for the most part, like we've been talking about. It's kind of got whimsy to it. It's almost this year's Big Fish, whimsy and sentimentality over self-importance.
I thought about Big Fish a lot in this movie too.
But it also does have that thing that biopics do, where like, the art is paramount. There's nothing more important than the art. And I think that's where this wife character comes back in. Because then at the end, after they sort of split, they're gonna have a divorce. She's with this new guy. She still comes to his opening of Peter Pan, and they talk. And then she forgives him. She says, but without that family, the one that Depp has been spending all of his time with and why she feels abandoned, and she leaves. She says, but without that family, you never could have written anything like this. You need them. What a selfless woman.
I didn't have a problem with that line. Because she had already, you know, basically, whether legally or not, she had divorced him. it was over.
Yeah.
She's not trying to rub it in necessarily. And she is happy for him with the art. I think
but
he can have both.
But what if the play sucked?
He can have both.
What if the play is no good? Then is his time spent away from his family?
Well, we wouldn't be watching. We wouldn't be making a movie about crap.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the same thing that I complain about with like characters Ryan Gosling plays, and they do this in movies a lot. Where if you get somebody who's good looking and or charming, but then give that character like no real reason for the audience to connect with them, they do anyway because it's a famous good-looking movie star. And it's like, that's a sort of shorthand. It's like a trick that filmmakers use to say like, well, you're going to care about this guy because he's the main character, even though I'm not going to give you any reason to care. And I think that's the same thing here.
Do you think that there's no good reason to care about Johnny Depp in this movie? His character
no,
from the beginning?
No, I'm saying that he shouldn't be absolved from completely abandoning his wife in order to play with little kids in the park because his play turned out well. Because if his play would have been bad, then she never would have been able to say this line. And so then how do you justify the fact that he just left her alone in the house every day to go play with Kate Winslet and her kids?
The relationship with his wife is definitely complicated. You, for the most part, you see for the first half of the movie, it's like Johnny Depp has a cold, unloving wife. And then in the second half or toward the end, you get these other scenes like you realize that she never was invited into his secret, you know, imaginative place.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tells, you know, J.M. Barrie is telling Kate Winslet's character about how his own brother died.
Yeah, his own brother died. Yeah, I can't remember.
Anyway, he's saying that I went to Neverland and I've never told anyone this. And you're like, you've never told anyone this? Not even your wife? And she complains about that afterward.
Yeah.
And so he hasn't been as open with her as he could have been either. And so there is, you know, there's both sides that are probably at fault with this marriage falling apart. And you wonder, why didn't he invite his wife into it? And then his wife says, I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of looking like a fool. His response is, well, I can't very well give up the play. So then she says, well, if you can't give us more of a chance, then we got to end it.
Yeah.
And I will end it. So whose fault is it that the marriage failed? At the same time, I felt like there's some falseness to her playing the victim there too, because she's pretty cold in most of the movie toward him. She doesn't seem like you could, they're sleeping in different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling about it is that that's sort of her choice. I don't know if
I'm not sure that's in the text.
It's not in the text.
Yeah.
But I feel like I don't know. You get sort of, I don't know. Is he glancing over at that room? Sort of like, you know, I feel like he's shut out of the marriage for the first half. That's my understanding, is that he's more shut out of it, and then you realize that she feels shut out of it too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's complicated. They're both probably at fault. But
he wrote a good play.
He did write a good play.
So it's worth the death of a marriage, I guess.
I don't think the movie is telling us that it was good for the marriage to end.
No, I don't think it's saying that either. Yeah. I think that it's basically just trying to, it's like, here's a silver lining. Don't think about the fact that this is a big deal, that their marriage is over, mm-hmm. because Peter Pan's a bigger deal. And it is.
My feeling of it was, it is a big deal, but my feeling was that this marriage was bringing happiness to neither party.
Yeah.
And so it didn't feel that sad that it was ending.
Yeah. It's funny. You're the one arguing for divorce here.
I know.
I never would have thought that.
It's crazy.
But if he is so emotionally distant that he can't even tell her that, hey, I was sad when my brother died when I was young,
yeah.
and give her any insight into that experience or try to bring her into any of his creative process. If there would be scenes where he showed her, hey, here's what I'm writing. I'm really excited about this thing. I'm gonna build off of this Neverland idea I had as a kid. And we see her being disinterested.
Yeah.
That's all we need. One scene in order to say she is selfish, self-centered, whatever. And Kate Winslet is interested. So
he's kind of a troubled character in that it seems that his make-believe becomes more real to him than real life.
Mm-hmm.
And make-believe can be good for coping with things or to, you know, make yourself imaginatively alive and come alive. But if it then becomes more important than real life, then you're going to lose your marriage as a result.
Yeah.
I'm good with my question part, and I want to go back to the golden take part, but did you have a different question?
Go ahead.
Specifically about this? Okay. So going back to this idea of whether the art and passion is benevolent or destructive.
Yes.
So in Finding Neverland, which is it?
The philosophy of the movie is that it's benevolent.
But you feel that maybe it's more complicated than the movie is really giving credit for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you on that. Mm-hmm. I think that for the most part, he feels more emotionally alive because of his art.
Yeah.
Despite his failed marriage, mm-hmm. than the art has caused the marriage to fail. I think generally I would still lean in that direction, but I see what you're saying the other way around. Okay, how about in Ray, benevolent or destructive? The art.
Benevolent, I guess.
I was thinking it's more destructive, but maybe it's really the drugs that are destructive.
Yeah, I see him, like his sort of personality is destructive. Mm-hmm. Without the music, he would be a total mess, I think.
Yeah.
So I see the music as something that rises him up almost in spite of mm-hmm. his personality.
How about Chocolat? If you consider the chocolate making
benevolent, as, clearly.
Definitely that's yeah. more benevolent. How about The Hours? So this is Virginia Woolf, yeah. Nicole Kidman, oof. Her art.
See, that's a tough one because you're bringing mental illness into yeah. it also. And then you have to ask yourself, is the writing a sort of a form of self-medicating? Is it a way of mm-hmm. coping, or is it a way to focus more on these negative emotions and anxieties? Ooh, this question is more interesting than the movie, I would say.
No way. The Hours is asking this question. That's what's so great. One of the things so great about the movie.
I don't know. I don't really remember it in detail enough.
I feel like it is benevolent for her, and she's dealing with other demons.
You
and
think
this
that,
is
it's a, that it's a soothing way for her to organize her messy life?
I think it's allowing her to get the most out of her mind, which is troubled. How about...
I can see it. I'm not going to argue with you about
we'll
that.
We'll have to watch it again.
Well.
How about Bridge on the River Kwai? Alec Guinness's bridge making as his passion.
See, we argued about this in the episode.
Is it a benevolent force for his character, or is it a destructive force for his character?
I think that the movie thinks that it's destructive, and I think that it's benevolent. It comes back to a philosophy of the movie and your takeaway yeah. from that philosophy conversation.
I think that ultimately he loses he thinks he's saving his soul through it, and he actually loses it. I think it's destructive. School of Rock, the music.
Come on, that's benevolent, baby.
I agree. That one's pretty simple. American Splendor.
Benevolent.
Harvey Pekar's comic book making, also I agree, benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is explicitly said, like, this is going to save you from cancer,
yeah.
from depressive state of cancer. How about Sideways with the wine? Mm-hmm. Is it destructive or benevolent?
I think this comes back to the Ray conversation yeah. of personality it's versus alcohol, passion.
Okay. I was thinking that the alcoholism is destructive for him because he... kind of, he acts like a madman in some situations, running down the hill with the wine, dumping the spit bowl on himself.
I don't think that he was,
but I don't
that
know
he was drunk in either of those cases though.
Nobody wanted to get drunk and he knew that that's where he was going.
Yeah. Yeah. I think to me that says more about his instability as a person. I think that his
the passion for wine.
Yes. I think passion for wine is good. And I think that yeah. we see that with Sandra Oh and with Virginia Madsen's mm-hmm. character. That could be a healthy thing, gives you something to be passionate about and collect and seek out and connect with others through.
Yeah. For him though, I think it's hard to disentangle it from the self-medication aspect of it. Like the fact that he's drinking that 1961 bottle by himself in some styrofoam cup.
It was going to peak, man.
It kind of shows
his window was closing on that thing.
It's destructive.
If you don't drink it now, you're not going to be able to drink it. It's going to turn to vinegar soon.
Will it?
Kind of.
I don't know the science of that.
It turns rancid sort of, and you don't want to drink it yeah. after a certain point.
All right. Well, that's my golden take. The passion, you can probably identify a passion, which could be art. In a lot of cases, it's kind of like this.
Yeah.
And the question is, does that help? Is that a benevolent or destructive force? Interesting
and
dichotomy.
And it is interesting with Sideways too, because as a way to sort of focus your energy, I think that wine is positive for him, but also destructive at the same time. Whereas it could just be a positive thing if you're Virginia Madsen.
This goes back to another dichotomy that I've proposed with. Is this a complex ending? Is it a simple ending?
Mm-hmm.
Is it an open or closed ending? What about this movie, Finding Neverland? Is it open or closed ending?
Closed. Parents are dead. They're gone. They're not coming back.
I think it's closed too, because you know that he's sort of the benefactor of the kids, and everyone agrees to that arrangement. It's a good arrangement, most people think.
Yeah.
Is it a complex or a simple ending?
Simple? I don't really remember your definitions
for
these.
Yeah, the complex, I guess, whether you have conflicting emotions and interpretations of the ending.
Yeah, simple.
Pretty simple.
Yeah. Is this the saddest feel-good movie of ever made? Or just of 2004?
I actually, afterward, I was telling my wife, because she watched this with me, I was like, I was kind of like, yeah, it's interesting how you can, you know, have this happy ending movie, and it doesn't feel like you're being forced into the happy ending. She's like, that's not a happy ending.
Yeah.
It's
a sad ending.
Yeah. But it's kind of got a lot of elements of both.
It's a sad feel-good movie.
Maybe it's complex. I don't know.
Maybe. So where are we in this episode? Are we at what might have been?
Are we bouncing around?
At your questions?
I am done. I'm at what might have been. Do you have a question?
Let's move on.
All right. What might have been? Tell me yes or no. Well, this is just an interesting factoid here, that 50 directors passed on the project before Mark Forster picked it up. And he had a choice of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban or Finding Neverland.
He should have gone with Harry Potter. He had a choice and he didn't pick Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I find that hard to believe.
Do you think that Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban will be talked about more in 20 years than Finding Neverland?
Yep.
I think so too. You think Harry Potter is going to get a reboot someday?
Yeah, probably.
It's got to eventually.
But I mean, even at that point, Harry Potter books were the biggest thing in the world. Now the movies were starting. It was clear they were going to make a movie based on every book.
I don't know how you
want to
get jumped into that. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because it's not like he was having these roaring successes after Monster's Ball. I mean, a lot of those that you mentioned, I'm not a fan of.
Yeah, I know. Mark Forster also had the chance to direct Brokeback Mountain and turned it down.
Oh, I'm glad he did.
Interesting.
Ang Lee.
I have not seen this yet. I'm looking forward to it next year.
Oh, it's great.
How about this? Jim Carrey as J.M. Barrie.
No. No.
Why not?
He would have been so tamped down and boring.
That's how he is in Eternal Sunshine, and that's awesome.
No, he's darker in Eternal Sunshine, and that's a contrast to his comedic sensibility.
Okay, but could he have been darker, brought a little more darkness into this role, potentially?
I think then we're going into dark territory with these kids. Why is he spending so much time with these kids?
That's true. That is an interesting line.
And that's another line
in
this movie that they're like, don't think about it. Here's some people flying on a stage, and then you're distracted from this like weird Michael Jackson thing that's going on.
Neverland.
See?
MJ.
Yeah.
We're on the same page where we love MJ, though, right?
Let's not talk about it.
All right. In real life, J.M. Barrie was almost always photographed with a huge walrus mustache. Should Johnny Depp have had a huge walrus mustache in this movie?
It would have made him look like P.T. Barnum or something. And I don't know, maybe he'd be a little too...
You think that would be distracting?
Maybe too kooky.
That's my favorite what might have been of today.
Would he seem more like an eccentric if he had that?
Would you trust him less?
I think so.
With a walrus mustache?
He's clean cut. How can you mistrust
this
guy?
Especially in the on the movie poster. I mean, they airbrushed those guys, their faces so much that it's like...
I hate the poster,
plastic.
Man. I can't stand the
it's
poster
plastic.
Of this movie.
Okay, so Julie Christie... I looked up a little bit about her career. So Julie Christie...
This is the mother character to Kate Winslet.
I did not realize what kind of a amazing career arc Julie Christie has had. So she was like the actress in like the late 60s. She turned down the role of Rosemary's Baby.
Wow.
turned down Chinatown in 74.
She hated Roman Polanski.
Turned down The Godfather.
What?
She was so big that she was wanted in everything. She was given $400,000 for a movie at that time.
Yeah.
And she's on like all the, you know, sexiest actress lists of everything back in the day. 1967, Time Magazine said, quote, "What Julie Christie wears has more real impact on fashion than all the clothes of the 10 best dressed women combined," end quote. She was a very big deal. And she had a long affair with Warren Beatty. And she kind of like withdrew from Hollywood life, was very picky about her movie roles, and ultimately came back in, you know, she was Gertrude in Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet in the 90s. And she's had quite a bit of success actually since then in these different roles as like a third phase of her career, basically. But anyway, I stuck this into the what might have been because of Rosemary's Baby, which I think that could have worked. Rosemary's Baby, Julie Christie.
I love Mia Farrow's face.
Yeah,
in that
she's
movie,
great.
Though.
I mean, it's hard to separate Mia Farrow because she's so iconic. But it'd be interesting to see. I have to go back and see some early Julie Christie movies. Also, it's hard to take Diane Keaton out of The Godfather. But again, Julie Christie is an interesting thing about there. All right, so with trivia. Johnny Depp requested, so Freddie Highmore was the young Peter, and Johnny Depp liked him so much that he requested that he play Charlie in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory the following year. Also interesting, Johnny Depp, you know, he goes from Pirates in 03.
Crazy career.
To Finding Neverland to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and throw in, I think The Tourist is 04 with Angelina Jolie. I haven't seen that.
A Secret Window is also a
Secret
04.
Window too.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, you see like, I think of usually like an actor does about a movie a year, you know, it's not really true. I mean, a lot of the filming happens in about a month anyway, for most, a lot of movies, 2 months maybe.
Yeah. I will say that this is kind of, I think, I mean, maybe there are ones I'm forgetting a little bit after this, but it's kind of this period where I start to not like Depp as much.
Yeah.
Like the Charlie and the, I mean, really it kind of aligns with how I don't like Burton and his part.
I know. I admire it, but I don't feel it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of Johnny Depp gets to be like making a weird face for a whole movie kind of thing. I think his acting is more impressive here than in other places.
But. Yeah. I do like him here and Jack Sparrow.
And he's great in Chocolat.
He's good in pretty much everything, but I don't know. He just hits that point where he's just playing like the Tim Burton weird eccentrics.
I know.
And
What about Edward Scissorhands?
I love that.
I do too. I would like to revisit that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So another trivia point. Freddie Highmore went on to star as Norman Bates in the Bates Motel series with Vera Farmiga as his mother.
I didn't connect that dot. But
Peter Pan to Norman Bates. Eileen Essel. This is an actress who was, you remember in Finding Neverland, there's this old elderly, I mean, senior, experienced, white-haired couple who talks to J.M. Barrie, you know, both plays. Well, Eileen Essel is the older woman in that couple. And she was like a stage actress for a long time. She didn't appear on the screen until she was 79, kind of famously like, at the very end of her career, just shows up in some movies.
Wow.
And I thought that was kind of cool. She died in 2015. All right. Keep it or kick it, Mike.
So I enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. Ray, I didn't really enjoy.
Yeah.
I did enjoy this and those moments that I mentioned before. I got a little choked up. I appreciated
cried
that.
Cried a little bit. A couple tears.
just a little bit. But if someone were to say that their experience with this movie was that it felt like a Hallmark movie, I wouldn't argue with them. And I think that the best scenes are scenes of Peter Pan, which I think is a problem.
From the play itself?
Yeah. If we're watching Peter Pan and saying, I want more of that, then maybe the story that takes up, you know, an hour and 30 of the 1 hour and 40.
I think, though, that when J.M. Barrie is like doing the make-believe stuff, like when he's a pirate, and he like goes into Jack Sparrow mode, just briefly. That's kind of cool though. And I love when, in that moment when they're like, they're on the ship and they're pretending that, you know, all this stuff is happening. And then like, while they're, while the camera is making it look like they're on the ship, he says something to one of the kids that is a reminder that, okay, actually we're just on a field.
Yeah.
That, that
we kind of jar back out of the fantasy.
The jarring in and out of the fantasy, I think is well done throughout. And there's a lot of situations.
And I do
like
too, that in the fantasies, everything looks very, very artificial.
Yeah. Like it, the waves in the,
yeah, they're not trying to make everything look like, you know, through digital effects real, but also fantastical. It's like, no, no, these are still like, you know, waves made of cardboard with blue tinfoil on them. Anyway, I enjoyed this movie. I think that it works. I'm going to tip my hat to it while I kick it off the pedestal, though.
So long. Nice knowing you. It was a nice hour and 40 minutes. I'm glad it wasn't a 2 hour and 10.
Yes. Yeah. It wouldn't have been a 3.5, I don't think, if it would have been 2 hours and 10 minutes.
You have like a starometer and it just starts slipping farther and farther down with every minute that
I
it
think
gets.
It's a matter of knowing when not to overstay your welcome. And a movie like this, if it's trying to pull those heartstrings, I think you can only do that so long before it starts crossing over into feeling manipulative. And this one,
it's no Irishman. Say that.
Come on. How about you?
I will also kick it. There were good things about it, but just not as much upside as some other movies of the year.
And there are a lot of good ones.
For example, in the next episode, we will talk about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I will not hide the fact that I love this movie. And I know you're a big fan of it as well. Charlie Kaufman's third movie, right? Third screenplay?
I don't know.
Being John Malkovich, and then an adaptation. And then he wrote Eternal Sunshine. He wrote Eternal Sunshine, did he not?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm not making that up. Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, again. She was nominated for her role in Eternal Sunshine, not in Finding Neverland. And Mark Ruffalo, too, is good in this movie.
Yeah. So, Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah.
She's in it too.
Tom Wilkinson.
Tom Wilkinson, yeah.
He's Wilkinson.
Elijah Wood. I mean, let's just name them all. We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think about Finding Neverland. Should it be in the top five of 2004? Let us know and we'll read your answers on the show. You can find us at bestpicturethis.com, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Best Picture This. And for 15 years of Golden Takes, head over to Letterboxd where you'll find me, Mike Cavalieri.
To support the show and help select a movie for a future bonus episode, visit patreon.com/bestpicturethis.
Thanks to WNZF and the illustrious Mark Gilliland for producing. And please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Best Picture This, the huge walrus mustache of movie history podcasts.